Yeah, I'm going to have to watch that for sure.
Mm, yeah, I think you would enjoy it.
We finally caught up on The Last of Us because I have not.
I'm still on the first episode.
Oh my, the first episode?
I haven't watched it anymore. I totally forgot about it.
Oh my gosh, you are in for it.
Whoops. Yeah.
Every single episode is like, I feel like there's something happens that just totally throws you off. And yeah. You think it's going to go one direction, it goes another direction. I don't know.
Yeah, I just need to. I get home at night and I'm like, I don't want to think about anything. So I usually just turn on something I've watched before.
With me, it's Friends or one of the Rock of Love or Flavor of Love or one of those shows.
Last night we just watched Game of Thrones, Joffrey's Wedding.
Oh, nice.
So I was like, only death in nice. Game of Thrones, where I cheered. So he has theories about who did it. And I said, so once you know who did it, we'll have to go back and watch the whole wedding reception. And I said, you see it. Like, you see, it's so subtle, but you see it. And you just don't notice it when it happens. And yeah. So he has theories.
You're so lucky you get to watch Game of Thrones for the first time with somebody that's never seen it.
He said, what did he say yesterday? He was like, I wonder why can't Bran control dragons? Why can't he get into the dragons' minds? And my face just went like, whoa. And I was like, I don't want to say anything because I don't want him to know that that doesn't happen. But that's a really good point.
I have thoughts about Bran Stark.
No, we have many thoughts about. I told him, I said, I will not talk about season 8. I want you to watch it and form your own opinions of it. I have strong opinions, but I won't say anything.
He already knows it's bad.
So he loves the Hound. He keeps calling him the Wolf. And I'm like,
the wolf?
I was like, the Hound? He's like, yes, the Hound.
The Wolf is a lot different in Game of Thrones land.
Yes. So I told him, I said, I have favorite characters too, but I can't tell you. Like, Tormund is my favorite, but I was like, I can't tell you about my favorite characters because right now, like, he's a very disliked character because he's a bad guy. So it's just fun. It's fun to see him experience it. It was so fun to see him experience the Red Wedding where he was like, oh my God. Yes. Alrighty.
I hope I don't sound congested or anything today. I have a little bit of sinus congestion.
You sound a little congested.
Do I really?
Mm-hmm.
That stinks.
You just sound a little stuffy.
Okay. I'm a little stuffy. Sorry, guys. Taking NyQuil and DayQuil and everything else and all
get
the other
quills.
Get
you some
quills. Mullen. Mullen?
Mm-hmm.
Is that an herb?
It's a plant. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I wonder if it grows around here. Probably not. We have like three plants that grow in the desert.
It's really great for upper respiratory, for sinus stuff. It breaks up crap in your throat. Or your chest. Yeah. So I have some. If you were here, I'd give you some.
So I really don't want to be coughing and sniffling all over this episode, but I've got to get it done.
You know, it happens. It happens and we work through it.
Yeah. It's not COVID or anything. It's just a little annoyance, basically.
It's so funny. Anytime I get like a stuffy nose, I'm like, it's not COVID.
I think that's what people are going to do from now on. I mean, I feel like that's just a thing. It's like, if you're sick, is it COVID or not COVID?
Yeah. I've learned, especially this time of year, our weather shifts so much up and down. And anytime we have a shift like that, like it messes with my sinuses. I'll get like my sinuses will hurt for about a day. Mm-hmm. So I've just kind of got used to it. Like next week, Thursday, it's going to be 73 here. And it was snowing the other day. So I'm like, this time of year is really, really fun for my body.
I've kind of learned that's
just what it does.
Yeah.
Not the COVID.
So I've got a fun story for us today.
I thought you said it was spooky.
Oh, it'll bum you out.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. It's pretty depressing.
Great.
That's why I made my fun. It's like fun sarcastically.
Oh, okay. It was a sarcastic.
My jokes aren't coming off well. I feel like my brain power is like dampened.
I get it.
I mean, what little brain power I have to begin with.
Shut up.
I'm going to talk about the death of Mark Kilroy.
Okay.
This happened in the 80s, and apparently it was a big deal.
Okay. I don't think I know this.
I didn't either. My sources are Wikipedia, very, very lengthy article with many resources at the bottom. An article from Texas Monthly, an article from APnews.com, and a paper from the U.S. Department of Justice Office of the Inspector General.
That's random.
And okay. A book. And a book, of course. And I'm going to withhold the title for now.
Okay.
Because it's a little spoilery for you. Our listeners will already have known by the time they read the title and description of this episode.
Okay.
But you don't know. All right. Mark Kilroy. He was born March 5th, 1968 in Chicago, Illinois to Jim and Helen Kilroy.
Who? Jim and?
Jim and Helen.
Oh, I don't know what I thought you just said. Okay. I thought you said Jim and Helen, like one name. I was like, who? Sit on what? Okay.
It's one
Jim
person.
And Helen. Got it.
I should have said Helen and Jim. That might have made it better.
Jim and Helen.
Jim and Helen. One person. Shortly after he was born, the family moved to Santa Fe, Texas, not New Mexico. This takes place in Texas. It's a small town outside of Houston, but it's really kind of geographically closer to Galveston.
Okay.
And Galveston's on the coast.
Yes.
Mark had a brother named Keith, and he was raised a Catholic, and his family was actively Christian and very loyal to their faith. This is a little important later on, especially to his parents and his brother.
Okay.
Mark was a Boy Scout and a smart guy. In high school, he played basketball, baseball, and golf. He was an honor student. He ranked 14th in a class of 210.
Whoa.
So he was a pretty cool guy. He was he excelled in a lot of things, pretty much everything he did. Mm-hmm. He was set up to go pretty far in life. He graduated high school in 1986 and attended a few colleges before transferring to University of Texas at Austin to study pre-med. So he was going to be a doctor.
Be a doctor.
So the story really begins on March 10th, 1989, when Mark's friend Bradley Moore would drive down from Texas A&M, where he was attending college, and drove to Austin to pick him up. The plan was for Bradley to head to Austin, pick up Mark, and they would drive down to Santa Fe and pick up two more friends, Bill Huddleston and Brent Martin, and the four of them are going to go to South Padre Island for spring break.
Ooh, fun. Have I been there?
South Padre Island? I don't know.
No, I have not, but I have been to Texas for spring break with the Stella's family. So, but
oh, where
I don't
at?
Think that that's, I can't remember. I'm like, I can't even remember. We went to the beach. Yeah, I don't remember. Anyway, go on.
It was about a 9 or 10 hour drive, so I don't know why South Padre Island and not Galveston or Corpus Christi or any place in between, but I've never been to the coast of Texas, so I don't even know if there's a big spring break scene in any of those places.
Corpus Christi, I think that's where I went.
Oh, okay.
But we were kids, so it wasn't like a party spring break. We were with her parents. And
so it was
high
spring
school.
Vacation.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I believe, and Stella might be listening to this. If I'm wrong, Stella, let me know. I think it's Corpus Christi. It wasn't, I don't remember it being like really party where we were, but my sister did go in college with her friends when she was in El Paso. They went to the coast and it was like more of your spring break type of deal.
Fun. I've never been to the coast of Texas ever.
It was fun. It was nice.
As some people know, in many coastal towns, spring break is a whole new season. Colleges have them at different times as well. So, and also non-college students like to go and party. Mm-hmm. So when Mark and his friends got there, it was still early in the season, but it wasn't even at its peak yet, but there were still thousands of people there.
Fun.
When they arrived, they all called home to tell their parents that they arrived safely. They met a group of girls right off the bat and partied with them until the next morning. And they established a routine. They would party at night, sleep in most of the day, wake up late, go to the beach for a while and hang out, watch the Miss Tan Line contest, go back to the hotel, clean up, and go back out for the night. Occasionally, they'd go out for food, but Mark always seemed to forget his wallet. So that became a joke among him and his friends about how they always go out to eat, and then Mark never has any money to help pay for things.
Whoops, I don't have any money.
I'm sure he's good for it, though, because he's like, my wallet's in the room. You guys know where I live. Come on.
Right. You know well, where to get your money.
I think it was Bradley, his friend Bradley, that they were friends since childhood. So it's cool that he leaves his wallet all the time. One night, they planned a trip into Mexico, so they left South Padre Island and headed to Brownsville so they could park on the United States side and walk over to Matamoros in Mexico. Along the way, they met another group of girls also planning to go. So the girls followed the guys to the parking lot. They spent a large chunk of the night at a bar called, which I love, Sergeant Pepper's.
Cool name.
The group split up and went their separate ways. Mark and his friends went back to South Padre Island in the early morning hours. On March 13th, the guys planned another trip into Mexico. They did the same thing. They parked in the lot on the U.S. side, walked over. And Matamoros is a huge spring break town. They cater to all the U.S. tourists. Mm-hmm. On this night, an estimated 15,000 people visited from the U.S. and most were spring breakers. That is so many people.
That's crazy.
And it probably helped that Mexico had much less restricted drinking laws than the U.S. had. And if my math is right, Mark had just turned 21 earlier in March, mm-hmm. so he was good to go anyway.
Either way.
Nobody was underage drinking. When they got there, they went to the bar with the shortest line, yay. And they bar hopped from there. Mark met some girls at one bar and stepped outside with them and sort of got away from his friends a little bit. At about 2 a.m., Bill said they should be heading back now. It's about an hour drive back to South Padre Island. Mm-hmm. And he stepped out of the bar and saw Mark across the street leaning on a car and talking to a woman from the Miss Tamline contest.
Miss Tamline.
But since there's so many people on the streets right now, it was really hard to kind of hook back up with each other and walk back in a
group. Keep track of people.
Right.
Reminds me of something like I would picture Mardi Gras or something. Just
maybe, yeah.
The craziness of it. Not that I've ever been to Mardi Gras, but yeah.
And this is 1989, so it's not like we have cell phones and you can text your friend and be like, hey, I'm right. in front of Sergeant Pepper's. You
drop
just have to find
like,
your
this
friend.
This is where I am.
Yeah. You can't locate each other easily. You just have to see somebody in a crowd and wave to them.
We have it so easy now.
We do. Bradley and Brent also got separated from the group, so they were off at another bar. Bill saw Mark say bye to Miss Tanline. He got Bill's attention and then waited for Bill to come over to him. So I guess they're seeing each other from across the road, like, hey, you come over, doing some kind of sign language. Mm-hmm. So Bill started to go over, and he stopped in this alley to pee while Mark was waiting for him. So when he was done, he came out and met up with Bradley and Brent, but the three of them lost sight of Mark. At about 4:30 a.m., the bars started closing and the crowds started thinning, but Mark's three friends were still looking for him. Hmm. They thought that maybe he had already crossed the border on foot, and then maybe he was waiting for them by the car, so they decided to go back over and see if they were right. Well, they didn't see him by the car, so they waited there a lot longer in case he was still in Mexico and decided to come back to the car. They waited a lot longer. Mark never showed up. So now they got to thinking, well, maybe he got a ride back to the hotel on South Padre Island with somebody else. Maybe the woman he was talking to and the girls he was hanging out with. And so they went back. They crashed in their room for a while. It's like wee hours of the morning. Everybody been drinking. They woke up the next day and Mark still was not in the room.
So they called
the police.
Scary feeling.
They called the police to report him missing. Now, usually in these kinds of cases, it's hard for officials to take them super seriously because you're dealing with thousands of drunk college students. Mm-hmm. Usually they get drunk and go off with somebody or crash with people they just met or pass out someplace. And then they turn up once they wake up and sober up and realize, well, that was a wild night.
Which is probably the case 9 times out of 10. But it's that 10th case where...
Exactly.
Or I
Mark
feel like
is the 10th case.
There should be a response to the police by the police all the time of let's treat this as worst case scenario.
Right. And so police thought this is what happened to Mark. Mark was fortunate that his uncle, Ken Kilroy, was a U.S. customs agent. So because of this and his connections to his job, he was able to put pressure on local police in Brownsville to search a little harder than they normally would. And as what sometimes happens to people in international cases or cases between two different jurisdictions or agencies, Brownsville tried to lead on officials in Mexico, and Mexican officials said that he likely disappeared in Brownsville. Mm-hmm. So basically the two towns are like, well, he's probably not here. You check.
Yeah.
And then nobody's really doing anything about it.
Right. It's your responsibility. He didn't go missing here. He went missing on your side.
Right. There was a discrepancy in numbers among some of my sources about how many people disappeared the first 3 months of 1989 in that area. Mark was one of about 60.
Oh, geez.
Some Mexican authorities would say that there was only a handful of cases, like single-digit numbers, but the numbers are lower on the Mexican side, so they want to not scare off tourists.
Right.
Because if people are going missing left and right in this town, no one, nobody's going to go there.
Right.
Officials in Matamoros were concerned that any kind of high-profile case like this would be detrimental to tourism. Even so, Mexican federal police agreed to work with U.S. investigators. So they assigned Mexican agents to accompany U.S. officials while they were in Mexico investigating, and together they would question people and take statements and basically try to figure out what happened to Mark. They called around to hospitals and morgues and brought Mark's three friends back to Matamoros to retrace their steps from that night and walk them through what and where things happened.
Mm-hmm.
And they did this on the U.S. side, too, just to make sure that Mark wasn't in an American hospital or morgue.
Right.
Mark's parents went so far as to fly to Brownsville and hand out flyers, and his mom even went to the border where everybody crossed, was handing out flyers, and the only Spanish that she knew was something like, por favor, mi hijo.
Oh.
Which means, woman. Please, my son.
Please, my son.
And I imagine they felt really, really lost and helpless because his parents really did everything that they could to keep attention on Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Because after a few weeks, I mean, there's thousands and thousands of people here. Anybody could have seen him.
Mm-hmm.
There's a million people who could have seen or heard something.
Mm-hmm.
But after a few weeks, too, the spring breakers would start to leave. So anybody that did see anything would going back home.
Yeah.
So they really, really tried to reach as many people as they could down there. They offered a reward for his return or information, but they had to decide what the appropriate amount would be. Because initially they went with $10,000. Which, the thing is, number one, if the reward was too high, people would call in false tips,
right.
Which happens a lot in cases like this. But number two, even worse, if the reward was too high, it could kick off a rash of kidnappings if people know that they can get easy money for kidnapping American spring breakers.
That is true. I never thought about that.
So they, like, in the book, his dad is a co-author of the book, and then he was writing about the struggle that they faced trying to figure out the appropriate amount of ransom money to where it's mm-hmm. enticing enough to get people to act, but also not enough to get people to kidnap other people because they did not want that to happen.
Right. I never really thought about that with offering rewards.
Yeah. I mean, if you offered, what, $1 million or something? Like, could you imagine? People right. would be kidnapped left and right because right. they'll get the ransom money.
Right.
Jim and Helen took many calls from people saying that they had information about Mark. And as the story unfolded in the media, of course, calls and sightings came in from all over. One caller called and called back several times, and Helen had orchestrated a money drop with him. She even went to a diner where the caller said he would be, but he never showed up. So he called back a second time, and she was like, let me talk to him again. So Helen means business. She's half worried, half fed up with these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I imagine she's feeling every emotion, but she's so smart. She told the caller, you have to bring, you show me proof that you have Mark. Like, please, just show me some kind of proof that you have him. So she got him to agree to bring a recent photo of him and his social security card, which the caller agreed to do.
Okay.
So she hung up. She tells the police they don't have Mark. And the police are like, how do you know? Well, remember, Mark had a habit of leaving his wallet in the hotel room. He never had it with him. Well, his friends brought it back when they returned back home. And give it to her. His social security card was in it.
Yeah. Smart. So she is very smart.
She is smart. So there's no way that they would have his social security card. A producer from America's Most Wanted heard about Mark's story. And they normally don't cover fresh, active cases. But in this case, they made an exception. They were so insistent on accuracy that they had Mark's friends tell them exactly where they were. So again, they go to Matamoros and retrace their steps at the exact same time of night that it actually happened.
Hmm.
The reward increased to $15,000, and Jim and Helen met with the governor of Texas, the Texas attorney general, and their U.S. senator to help them with Mark's disappearance. So they are getting up there.
All the way to the top.
All the way. Oh, this goes even farther to the top. The Texas officials agree to contact the Mexican governor and work with them higher up to help with the case. So things are moving up the ladder. And the federal officials were making things happen, but the local officials, not so much. It did not help that most people are scared of local Mexican officials, given that corruption and violence was kind of rampant among them.
Right.
Plus, many knew that sometimes Mexican police would throw spring breakers in jail and sort of ransom them out for bail. You know, kind of like how you hear in some places you'll get pulled over by the cops and they'll give you a speeding ticket and they say, well, if you give me, you know, $50 cash now, we'll just let you go. It's kind of a bribe.
Yeah.
Basically. So this is what they do. They throw a spring breaker in jail and say, okay, give me some cash and I'll let you out and we won't book you.
Mm-hmm.
And people pay up. Mark's been missing just 2 days now. And since the family has received no credible calls regarding a ransom or demanding money, police now suspect foul play. The working theory now is that Mark got involved in a robbery, murder, or got in between some kind of drug-related killing, or maybe he just saw something he shouldn't have seen, and maybe he was killed for it. Or he could have been a victim of a police beating, and it's just being covered up.
That's such a jump from, oh, he just ended up with people and is partying, to, oh, he was actually murdered because he saw something. Like, oh my gosh.
Right. And he wasn't like, he wasn't a heavy drinker. He wasn't a drug user. Like, he was just a dude that just wanted to go have fun with his friends on spring break. I mean, I'm sure he partied a lot, but I don't think he's going on some coke bender in Mexico. Right. Like, this does not sound like Mark at all. So Bradley Moore even went under hypnosis. And under it, he said he remembered a man talking to Mark who said, hey, don't I know you from somewhere? And this man was Hispanic, because Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a visible scar on his face, and he was wearing a blue plaid shirt. Bradley didn't remember if Mark had said anything back, but I think the answer was, no, I don't know you from somewhere. Still, none of the three could pinpoint the exact time or place where Mark disappeared, only the point that they last saw him. Investigators thought that maybe he was kidnapped for robbery because if it was for ransom, they would have got a ransom demand by now.
Right.
So maybe somebody kidnapped him just to take him off in an alley somewhere and steal his valuables and either killed him or let him go.
Right.
But if he were kidnapped for robbery purposes, it's likely he wasn't alive. Otherwise, he would have turned up by now.
Right. It's been a couple days.
Mark himself would have called 911 somewhere and reported it.
Right.
So now the search for Mark became a search for Mark's body.
Oh, God.
Helicopters and four-wheelers were deployed to search the land around both cities, Matamoros and Brownsville. They even scoured much of the Rio Grande River in case they found his body there, but they found nothing. Actually, they found one body in the river, but it was in connection with something else.
Oh, gosh. That's always sad when
you're
looking for one person and you find someone else.
Well, remember when they were looking for Brian Laundrie and then they found like bodies everywhere?
Oh, yeah. Well, and Gabby, too. Gabby, too.
Yeah.
They were finding hikers who had been lost. And
yes.
I can't remember how many they recovered just from searching. So
it was a lot. I mean, on one hand, it's sad. But on the other hand, it's like at least families can have closure if we can identify some of these people.
Right.
On April 1st, 1989, the Mexican Federales, that's the federal police, they had a checkpoint set up to check vehicles for drugs. And one truck ran it without stopping.
Suspicious.
What are you talking about? It happens all the time. It had come from Texas, and instead of just hitting their lights and sirens and pulling it over, they decided to just follow it, see where it goes. It pulled into a ranch called the Santa Elena Ranch outside of Matamoros, and the cops just watched it for a while from a short distance. In about a half hour, the truck left the ranch again, and the Federales moved into the ranch to look around. I guess they don't need warrants or anything. I don't know how that goes. Or maybe they did call and get one and this just didn't specify. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know the legal system down there.
I don't either. There they found marijuana and evidence of drugs. So the driver of the truck that ran through the roadblock was Serafin Hernandez Garcia. He was the nephew of a local drug lord. So to try and gain more information about this drug operation, the Federales decided not to arrest him right away. They just wanted to keep an eye on the ranch and watch the comings and goings for a couple days. Mm-hmm. After doing this and talking with a few informants, the cops there arrested Serafin Hernandez Garcia, along with his uncle Elio Rivera, David Valdez, Sergio Salinas, and Domingo Bustamante, the caretaker of the ranch. A lot of people, a lot of names. You don't have to remember all of them. Okay. So these guys, although arrested, they're pretty chill while they're in custody. They're acting like it's no big deal. Police separated them and questioned them, and things got interesting when they questioned Domingo, the caretaker. He said, first, the ranch had a lot of visitors from Seraphine's drug operations.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, just even though it's unrelated, just for, you know, I don't know, throw in spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks is a phrase I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
They show him a picture of Mark and they said, hey, have you seen this guy? And the caretaker said, yeah, I saw him.
Oh, okay.
And then they were like, what?
So he said, yeah, that one.
I talked to him and I made him some eggs for breakfast. Like, what's the big deal?
Just made him some eggs.
Yeah, made his breakfast. So police questioned Seraphine and he was surprisingly honest, saying that he also saw Mark at the ranch and that several people, including Mark, had been killed there in the past few months.
Oh, people are just admitting to things. I mean,
there's a reason. Okay. And I will tell you, this reason is crazy. Police learned that Seraphine had scouted people to kidnap and actually was just about to grab somebody else until a car cut him off and he lost that person in the crowd and then he saw Mark.
Oh, wow.
How close did that dude come? That person
had no idea.
No.
Oh, that messes with your mind. You think of things like that.
And you know what? We don't even know. That person doesn't even know who it is. It could be any of the 15,000 people that were there that day.
Right. No idea.
So he saw three people go up to Mark and talk to him, which was his friends, and that kind of disappointed him. But then they split up again, so Mark was talking to the woman, probably the Miss Tanlon girl. And he was glad to see him drop her off and split off, so Mark was alone. So he followed Mark until he met up with Bill. Then when Bill turned down the alley to pee, this was Seraphine's chance. He approached Mark, said, "Don't I know you?" So they were right. When he went under hypnosis, it was right. Mm-hmm. And Mark said no. He told Mark he would give him a ride across the border if he needed one. And Mark said, no, thanks. I'm waiting on my friends. And then Seraphine said, well, bring them. I'll give them a ride too. And again, Mark said no. And so Seraphine and an accomplice just grabbed Mark and forced him into a pickup truck and drove off.
Mm.
It was so fast. As soon as he was grabbed, the truck immediately turned down a side road. Mark was handcuffed and Seraphine got it. And his buddy stopped to get out to pee in an alley.
Wait, the truck driver?
Yeah, both of them did.
Oh.
And left Mark alone in the truck. So Mark opened the door and ran off.
Good for him.
Yes. Yes, Mark. But a car behind them almost immediately put their headlights on him. They stopped. Three people got out with guns, put them on Mark and said, freeze, police. So Mark is like on his knees, handcuffed, hands up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So while questioning the men, the cops arrested at the ranch. They were actually laughing and joking about all this because they were all in it together. The two cars were part of the same operation.
Oh, okay.
And the Mexican police were a little baffled and it was explained to them that American cops use that term a lot. And since Mark was an American and taught to obey authority, he would comply.
Right.
So,
yeah.
And he was already handcuffed. So Mark probably thought it was actual police officers.
It was police and he had done
something. And they're
here
to help me. Right. Yeah. Or they're here to help.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So these guys are all laughing and patting themselves on the back and joking around and talking about how clever they were just to get him to like comply immediately and kind of arguing over who gets credit for using the phrase first.
Cool guys.
They're very arrogant, these drug dealers. Police learned that Mark was brought to the ranch and here stories differ a little bit about exactly what happened. The book I read mentioned that Mark was being kept in a small shed until the next day, and then Domingo, the caretaker, was ordered to cook him some breakfast, feed him, and then, quote, go tend to your goats. So basically make him some breakfast and
go tend to your goats.
Shoo fly, don't bother me. A New York Daily News article, although they're a tabloid, said Mark was beaten and sodomized throughout the rest of the night.
Oh.
I kind of trust the book a little bit, though, because the book actually talked to some of the Mexican investigators in mm-hmm. great detail because Jim Kilroy kind of became friends with some of them that helped him out. Either way, we do know that about noon, Mark 8, it was about 12 hours after his kidnapping, and a man named Adolfo Constanzo came to see him. Mark's eyes and mouth were covered in duct tape, his hands were tied around his back, and he was stripped nude. He was taken to a building at the ranch they called the Temple, where Constanzo hit Mark on the back of the head with a machete, like several machete blows, but it killed him fast. He then extracted Mark's brain to put in a large cauldron called a Ganga. I hope I said that right. Costanzo and his men prayed over it, hoping that their offering of a smart, handsome, young college student like Mark would please the gods of their cult that they were involved
in. Oh, no.
Yeah, this is where the bummer starts happening.
Dark, black magic going on right now.
Oh, yeah.
Human sacrifices.
Seraphine told investigators that Costanzo had ordered the killings as part of a ritual human sacrifice, believing it would provide them supernatural protection against any harm as they ran their drug operation.
Well, clearly it didn't, because the cops pulled up, so didn't work.
They believed it would bring them strength and wealth and immunity from law enforcement or injury. This is why they were all so casual and laughing and arrogant when they were arrested, because they thought their gods would protect them.
Right.
So Seraphine took the police to the ranch to show them where Mark was buried. He walked to a southwestern corner of this little corral and pointed to a wire sticking out of the ground and told them, dig here. So about halfway through, Seraphine says, dig over here too.
Oh, no.
So they go and dig over there. Again. Oh, yeah, over here's a spot. And this goes on. About 13 bodies were discovered on this ranch.
Oh, however, gosh.
Some were just regular victims of drug violence. They were found with bullet holes and their clothes on, while the ritual sacrifice victims were found a lot differently.
Yeah.
This gets a little morbid. After killing a victim and extracting their brain, they would cut out the person's spine and run a wire through it. They would mutilate the bodies and cut off a person's legs at the knees and bury them face down with the legs on top. The spine was then buried on top of that with the wires poking out of the ground.
Oh, that was the wires.
Yep, that was the wires. What they would do is when the body decomposed for a long enough time, they would just pull the wires up and pull the bones out of the ground. And the abrasiveness from the dirt and all would help clean them up. And so they would polish them and clean them and then wear them as necklaces during ritual ceremonies for protection.
No. What kind of cult is this?
Kind of a dumb one.
I'm like, yes. What kind of cult? It's not a good one. Obviously, they're sacrificing people, but yeah.
After they buried Mark, several men stood by and guarded his burial site with guns for the rest of the day. Apparently, this was according to the book, some of the guys talked about treating the victims with respect. And even during their police interrogations, when they talked about what they did, they talked about their victims almost with reverence. And this is why I don't know if the New York Daily News article about him being tortured and sodomized was legit.
Yeah. It is twisted. In their own mind, they're respectful of him because he's serving a purpose for them.
I mean, they're offering him to their gods. And if they love their gods, they're going to treat their gift well. Right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And again, Jim Kilroy had access to a lot of the investigators. So, and the New York Daily News did not. So I believe him. And as for Mark's belongings, people would ask, you know, why did you steal his stuff? Like, where is it? And they said, we don't steal. We don't steal from our victims. What they would do was take all the stuff together, drive around town and just throw things out the window randomly, like his clothes and whatnot. And he had a gold watch that had belonged to his grandfather that he wore. Mm-hmm. And they even tossed it out the window because somebody walking down the street could just find this gold watch and it like makes their day. It's like a gift to them.
Right.
So they don't keep the things for their own,
blessings. No, we don't steal from them. That's disrespectful, but we will cut out his brain.
And spine. That's and so cut off weird. His legs and murder him.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So they think that, you know, it gains good fortune with their gods to treat their victims and the victims' belongings with respect. It's so
not the victim.
I just can't. My brain can't do it. But then again, I'm not a member of a cult.
You're not in
a cult.
I don't murder people. You shouldn't be able to understand it. That's what I have learned with researching some of these things that I try to understand. And then I have to tell myself, it's okay that you don't understand this. That means you're kind of a normal person.
Another discrepancy was the amputation of the legs. The book mentioned that Seraphine saying Costanzo did it because it was a way to, like, quote, eliminate fear of things. Like, if you just chop off, like, parts of bodies, you do it to a certain point where you're no longer scared of anything and you feel invincible.
You're just desensitizing yourself?
Right, I guess. The Texas Monthly article said that they was just to simplify the burial so they could dig a smaller hole.
That makes more sense.
This is something I struggle with a bit at the beginning of the story because there's like some discrepancies like that. But again, I think the book, they had more access to people involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the book will be biased like toward Mark's side a little bit, but at the same time, they have pictures and maps and everything in this book that I couldn't find anywhere else. So like, I believe the book. Although the truth may be somewhere in between. I don't know.
It could be in between. Yeah.
Well, remember way back in like way, way back when I did the story about the Peruvian ice mummies and how they were human sacrifices?
Yes.
When they chose those kids, like they treated them like royalty for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. They were fed well. They lived in good environments.
Right.
Yeah.
They wore the finest clothes. They got the best food. They were parading through the streets and everybody was just like crying and like
worshiping
them basically because they were a gift to the gods and the gods were the ones who decided if you lived or died, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think if Mark got this treatment, then maybe they really believed it. If Mark did not get this treatment, then maybe they were just not as
covering
devoted
for themselves. Yeah.
Right. They had to have believed something, though. Otherwise, they just would have killed him and put him in the ground. So most of Constanzo's followers did tell police how much they feared him, though. So Constanzo said he was able to tell the future at times and that he could control the spirits of his sacrificial victims and that these spirits would become spies that work for him now. So a lot of people probably went along with it because they feared him.
Mm-hmm.
Which you hear a lot in cult cases.
Right.
So his drug operation gave him money, but it was his cult practices that gave him his power. Whatever Constanzo called his little cult was a mix of, please let me get this pronunciation right, Palo Mayombe practice, which was a mixture of Afro-Cuban beliefs sprinkled with the little ancient Aztecs beliefs, maybe a little Christianity. It was a little bit from a lot of things.
Okay.
I was trying to like take a deep dive and figure out a lot about them, but holy crap, it is confusing. Especially when you have a blend of places like Mexico, where they have ancient Aztec culture and religion, and then like Afro-Cuban things, and then African religions, and voodoo, and Santeria. And I'm like, I can't keep it straight.
It's just a little everything.
It is. It's a little, it's like the allspice of
it's the allspice of cults.
Yes, it's the allspice of cults.
Not saying that like voodoo beliefs are a cult or that African religions are cults. Like those are like, not saying that those are all not legit religion and practices, but it is almost perverting those.
It is, or it's taking one little piece of it and just creating
I don't want people
this
to think that I'm calling.
No, not at all.
I don't want people to think I'm calling those religions cults. It's kind of twisting those beliefs to.
Yeah, it's like they're taking parts of it and creating their own little worse thing.
Yes.
I mean, I knew a guy in Florida that was like Santeria. I think it was Santeria that he practiced. And, like, he would have, like, a statue of, like, a saint in his house, and he would just, like, give it little coins and offerings and things, and he would carry this little thing in his pocket, and it
I'm
had,
Catholic.
Like, little trinkets in it.
I grew up Catholic. I mean, you walk into any Catholic home, and you'll have a statue of Mary.
Yeah. And you go to church, and you have, quote, the blood of Christ. You eat, quote, the body of Christ. I mean, it's not a literal human body, but in
May crowning, you crown Mary's statue. That my sister got to do that 1 year, so that's
how. Oh, cool. Like,
yeah, but yeah, so.
But if you took somebody that had never, ever heard of Catholicism, ever, like an alien to this planet, and you say, yeah, we have the body and blood of Christ, and they're like, what? You're cannibals? What?
Well,
what are you
so
doing?
It's funny, too, like when people will be like, oh my God, that's pagan. And I'm like, do you not pay attention to what happens in Catholic Church? You eat the body of Christ and you drink the blood of Christ and you chant and like, really?
I did a research paper in college about the Spanish conquest of Mexico. And I forgot the guy's name, but one guy was writing about, he was a Spanish priest and he was Catholic and he was sort of defending the Aztecs And he was one of the few that actually did, because a lot of times Christianity back then was, it's better to kill the non-believer than to let him live and be a heathen. So thou shalt not kill had a little asterisk by it.
Yeah, except for these people.
But this priest was like, look, he was very love thy neighbor and whatnot. And he's like, killing them is not the way to get them to convert and know Jesus. Like, what? Like, and they have practices like, yes, they have, you know, human sacrifice and drinking blood or whatever it is. But he's like, do we not do the body and blood of Christ as communion? Mm-hmm. And he brought up that exact same thing. He's like, it's symbolism with us. With them, they do it a little differently, but it's like we can teach things a little more peacefully. But he brought up those same comparisons that you have these two different religions that are complete opposite each other. And,
but they're really not the complete opposite of each other when you think about it.
Yeah. And I think he may have brought that up too. I wish I could remember the priest's name, because he was my favorite in the whole paper, because he was the actual nice one. But he was talking about how, yeah, they have human sacrifices and we see that as horrible, but we're also killing non-believers. So we're killing people too.
Right. Yeah.
So
when you're digging
pick one.
Down to the bedrock of all of it and just looking at the basis of so many of these religions, they're the same.
The Mexican officials were so nervous and superstitious about the ranch that before investigating the little shed with the cauldron and candles and markings on it, they had a shaman of some kind come in and bless it to remove all the bad spirits. And when they were finished, they burned it down completely.
Okay.
Some of the police officers would not even go in until this was done. And I can kind of understand that too. Again, it goes back with, you know, superstitions and beliefs of the time, because in Mexico you have ancient Aztec beliefs and Mayan beliefs and then Christian beliefs that come in later. So there's a huge, huge history of spirituality there.
Oh,
over
absolutely.
Here, we just had the white Europeans that were Christian come over, and we don't have a lot of that mix and we don't have a lot of that history. So it's hard for
us
to understand.
We have the mix just from other cultures that have come here, but
yeah. But we're also too a really young country.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
You know, Mexico is a lot older than the United States is.
We're babies.
And we didn't get a lot from native and indigenous people's beliefs. It was Christianity kind of took a lot of things over. Either way, his followers were so scared of Constanzo's wrath and all of him turning the spirits on them that when Seraphine was talking to the cops and they were digging up the bodies, he proposed a deal. Seraphine did. That if they would just extradite him to the U.S., he would confess to any crime that they chose.
What?
This is how scared he said he was of Constanzo. And okay. I'll take whatever punishment. I know you guys have the death penalty. We don't have that here. You have it there. That's fine.
You have it.
Tell me what to confess to. I'll do it.
And I'll do it. Yeah.
That's how scared some of these people allegedly were of this Constanzo guy. So right now, authorities have the major players in custody, but Constanzo is still free. And Mark's story of his death is gaining international attention, so it's only a matter of time before Constanzo finds out that he's a wanted man. On April 11th, he fled to a Holiday Inn in Brownsville with a few other cult followers and flew to Mexico City, where he kept an apartment.
Just love that it's Holiday Inn. I don't know why. That just is funny to me.
And just like with Mark, once his picture is out, calls flood in with alleged sightings all over U.S. and Mexico. In Matamoros, police raided the house of Sarah Aldrente, one of his followers and the only woman in the cult that I know of, who in Mexico was a high-ranking cult official. And in the U.S., she was a friendly, outgoing student at a university in Brownsville.
Wait, you just never know a person.
Holy double life, Batman.
I know.
I don't talk much about her because she really didn't have a whole lot to do with Mark, but every single story lumps her and Constanzo together, so I didn't want to like overlook it. I could have taken this story and branched out and elaborated on so many different directions, so I had to make sure that I narrowed it down and kept the focus on Mark and his story.
Right.
Anyway, at her house, they found candles and altars, some religious symbols, and blood on the walls.
Ew, great.
So arrests are starting to be made more and more with the various people connected with Constanzo and his drug operation. And as homes are searched of these people, they're commonly finding candles and altars and little things associated with cult practices. One house they found had paperwork, including a list of properties that Constanzo had bought. So in Mexico City, authorities raided one of these properties, finding a hidden ritual chamber with an altar in it. And Constanzo had a secret. A big pile of gay porn.
Okay. Not very religious-y.
I just find it funny too that a lot of these cult leaders and religious leaders and some of the like big mega church people that, you know, it's like, give your money to God, and they're flying around in Learjets. But it's like, I'm this huge leader and I'm like, I got the secret. I can't tell anybody about it. And I'm like, you're a fraud. Just be honest with yourself. Come on. Anyway, now police are focusing in on the gay community in Mexico City to see if anybody there may have heard of him or know his whereabouts. So now they kind of have a clue. And the Mexico City police started seeing similarities between the Matamoros murders and some murders that had taken place there in the past few years. Together, they consulted with local witchcraft practitioners and thought Constanzo might be hiding out in one of the city's neighborhoods where people who practice certain rituals hang around. So now they have another in. They narrowed it down to one street, and the city sent in 16 police officers to check it out. There, they saw a man who looked suspicious, like one of Constanzo's henchmen, buying groceries with U.S. dollars. Okay. Probably for him, because he would not go out in public.
Mm-hmm.
On May the 6th, police surrounded the building and raided the apartment, but Constanzo opened fire from his apartment window. There was a gunfight that lasted about 45 minutes between him and all of these police officers. And at times he would just throw coins out the window and he would burn paper money on the stove. And apparently the coins were offering to the gods for protection, which they're not like, doing the
just
job.
Just take these, help me.
Right. And he burned the paper money simply because he had that mentality of, if I can't have it, nobody can.
What an a-hole.
I mean, he's a cult leader.
I mean, I didn't have any doubts about that, but...
I mean, what cult has ever worked? They're killing people as human sacrifices to get protection from police. And obviously it's not working because police are surrounding you and it's not working.
Yes, you like, might want to reevaluate your priorities.
Who would join a cult after this? Like, none of them have worked out ever.
And yet people still join them all the time because they don't realize they're in cults.
Ever. When he was dangerously close to running out of ammo, he ordered one of his followers with him to kill him. The man didn't want to, but Constanzo punched him and beat him until he agreed.
Okay, that's a good way to get people to do what you want.
Saying he would command that his spirit suffer in hell if he didn't. So I don't know why these powerful cult leaders, like Jim Jones and all, don't just kill yourself.
Right, because they're narcissists and they can't do it. They are narcissists.
I mean, you're the super powerful supreme cult leader. You control the spirits. You kill other people. You order other people to kill for you, but you can't even put a gun to your head and pull a trigger?
Yeah, because they're selfish. They're narcissists. They won't do it.
They're all so fake. Nobody join a cult.
That's good advice.
So he hugged a third follower with him that was with him. So they're like embracing. It may have been his lover. I don't know. The guy opened fire. He killed them both. Sarah was there. She ran from the apartment screaming that he was dead. So police went up and made their arrests. Apparently, Constanzo was going crazy before, saying that everything was lost and nobody can have my money and all that crap. And of course, everybody they arrested said that they had knowledge of the cult killings, but only Constanzo did those. Of course. They either just stood by or they had indirect knowledge of them. People are starting to distance themselves now.
Yeah.
Sarah said she didn't know about them at all until she saw it on TV, but I doubt it. If you're his number two, I'm sure you were aware of some things happening.
Yes.
I can't even begin to describe the charges that were brought and the number of people that were charged. The list would take forever to read. Trust me when I say it's a lot. Many, many people were arrested. They were charged with so many crimes. Weapons crimes, kidnapping, murder charges, drug charges, you name it. After Constanzo's body was recovered, they even went so far to fingerprint it just to make sure he didn't fake his death somehow.
Oh, that it was him. Yeah.
As of 2009, only two people involved in Mark's murder remained at large. I could not find anything on them that was more recent than that. So I have no idea if they're still at large today, if they're dead, if they've been arrested or what.
It could be someone's neighbor.
Oh, God, I hope not. I hope they just died in like drug wars or something and they're gone. Yeah. So now the aftermath. It gets a little better.
Okay.
Shortly after Mark's body was found, his parents started the Mark Kilroy Foundation, which is still active today. They promote drug awareness and education and provide scholarships to high schoolers, especially those wanting to go to medical school.
Oh, good.
Jim wrote in the book that although Mark didn't use drugs, drugs are still ultimately what killed him. And he offered up some solutions and program ideas to help people combat drug abuse.
Okay.
He did talk a lot about marijuana, which I personally don't think marijuana is that bad, but like heroin and cocaine and all, some of his ideas were really good. I think he had some good ideas. He had, like, for example, I don't have the book with me exactly, but people getting caught with drug crimes, like having mandatory Narcotics Anonymous classes or rehab programs, depending on the severity of the offense. So say you're just caught smoking a joint on a park bench. Well, maybe you just take a few classes, but a harder addict might be sent to a mandatory rehab program.
Yeah.
He was saying how there's punishment for drug crimes in the U.S., but there's no rehabilitation, which I agree.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's we have true. A for-profit prison system. So as long as prisons are profitable, I mean, people are not going to focus on rehabilitation. They're going to focus on punishment. So this foundation would help a lot of people overcome addictions and give people access to resources they need to do so, which I think is really, really cool. They had a program for schools around the Santa Fe area. And in the summer, they had an average of 550 students take part in it.
Wow.
It's like a fun summer camp where they had archery and tennis and swimming, and people can go do fun things, that's learn cool. about the dangers of drug and substance abuse and get help if they need it, have access to resources.
DARE, but more fun.
Oh, God, so much better than DARE, which I'm going to talk about that in a few minutes. But basically, they learn early on the dangers of drug abuse, how to get help or resources should they find themselves addicted or whatnot. And it basically keeps kids from getting in trouble, keeps them off the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark's parents are big advocates for college students on spring break. They advise them to stay in groups, don't get separated, beware of travel, like where you're traveling internationally, and basically look out for each other.
Also have a plan and don't deviate from that plan.
Right.
Like, don't have one person be like, oh, I'll just meet you guys later, or meet you back at the car or whatever. Or
right.
Because like they went back to the car and they're like, well, maybe he got a ride home from somebody else. And
yeah,
like always have a plan and don't deviate from that. And if there is any reason why you have to, always make sure that somebody knows.
Right. And after his funeral too, after Mark's funeral, which was huge, there was like 500 or 600 people in like in this church and like 700 or 800 people outside, and they broadcasted part of it like outside. Wow. There were so many people there. His whole town had like yellow ribbons for him.
Mm-hmm.
And like everybody came out for this, and they raised so much money too. And then Jim and Helen were like, all right, well, we're going to use some of this money to give to the families of the other victims at the ranch so they could bury their dead.
Mm-hmm.
And they had so much food, and they're like, we're never going to use all this food. So they donated it all. Because you know how people cook for you after funerals? Because you don't feel like cooking yourself and whatnot. Yeah,
there's always there's a reception.
There's so many people there. They donated a lot of it to a food bank, and they didn't get any donations in a while. So it like filled them up, and they had enough food to feed everybody for like days and days.
Wow.
So all these things are pretty good. And it's really sad that Mark died. I'm sure they would rather have their son back. But
yeah,
it's helping a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
They even met with President Bush, George Bush, not Iraq War Bush, but Daddy Bush.
Daddy Bush.
And his National Drug Policy Director, William Bennett, in August of 1989. So it goes way to the top, to the President of the United States.
You said it does.
Bennett said that, quote, the Kilroys have taken their pain and tragedy and turned it into a very good effort. Helen said Bush and Bennett did not specify any specific recommendations about fighting drugs, but she's satisfied that the administration was moving in the right direction and praised them for asking others about what can be done and for listening to them and whatnot.
I think they failed ultimately.
Oh, God.
But that's a different story.
The government did. I don't think the Kilroys did, because
no,
I feel like Jim and Helen are doing what they can do.
Yeah, no, the government.
And I love that they're taking, and I love that the Kilroys were taking a personal tragedy to them and turning it around to use it to help people.
Mm-hmm.
That's not easy for some people to do. And this is where them being Christians come in, and actively like loyal Christians.
Mm-hmm.
But remember when President Bush had that speech and he held up like a bag of crack and he said he got it across the street from the White House?
Yes.
I don't know if you remember this. Well, the DEA did get it across the street from the White House. However, the DEA went and got a drug dealer from way far away, brought him to the park across the street from the White House so they could do the deal and basically entrap him.
Yeah, entrapment, which is not legal.
So they could say that they got crack across the street from the White House.
Oh my God.
Why didn't they just lie and say that they got it across the street from the White House and just go find some crack from somewhere else? I don't know.
Just go find some other crack.
But the guy that sold it to him, his name was Keith Jackson. He was 18 years old. He got a mandatory 10-year sentence for it. And he really got framed. This was also the same president who, when he was Reagan's VP, you know, knew that the CIA was distributing crack cocaine into black neighborhoods in Los Angeles and using that money to fund the Contras in Honduras. They're a right-wing rebel group.
It's all twisted.
So, and remember Barbara Bush, just say no.
Just say no. Yes.
And DARE programs in school and all?
Yeah, I remember in my elementary school, like, they had like an honor of like the top DARE student or whatever. And I remember the guy who got it. And then in high school turned out to be a huge druggie and drug dealer and everything. And I remember thinking like, well, that worked out really well.
My DARE officer got arrested for marijuana possession.
I actually really liked my DARE officer because he was really good friends with my cousin and super nice guy. He came to my grandma's funeral. Like, he was a super nice guy. So I don't fault him at all, but the whole drug, like the DARE program, was just a joke. But he was really cool. I did like him.
I don't know if we have a lot of younger listeners that didn't have to do DARE programs,
like, what is
DARE? If they still do it today. It was an acronym for Drug Abuse Resistance Education. And they had, I think I was in fourth or fifth grade. I was in elementary school. And they would have police officers, like actual police officers, come in and talk to your class. And they did it like once a week or however long it was, about drug abuse and why drugs are bad. Okay. It was very Mr. Mackey from South Park. And they had you thinking that when you got out into the world and you were no longer a kid, that people would be jumping out of alleys in trench coats offering you drugs.
Yes.
And you got to check your Halloween candy for drugs because people are going to lace your candy with drugs.
Yeah.
And like, basically it was, everybody is out to get you and is going to get you hooked on drugs. They made it sound so terrifying that it was such a problem. And I just want to say, as an adult that has lived through all this, nobody has ever offered me free drugs.
Never once have I been approached of someone trying to give me drugs.
I'm so disappointed.
Never happened.
And drugs are expensive, by the way. Really expensive. And nobody's putting them in Halloween candy. Nobody is giving their edibles away in Halloween candy because, again, they are expensive.
They want to keep their edibles.
And what are they going to do? Get kids hooked on drugs because kids have a lot of disposable income.
Right.
We talked about this before.
Kids can't buy drugs from you.
I think we've talked about this before, is like how just absurd it sounds to us now.
Yes.
But also, I mean, people might accuse me of getting political or whatever, but I don't care. But it's just a fact. At the time, the government was Republican led and they were telling us about all these dangers of drug use and drug abuse and whatnot. And the war on drugs had started and how bad it was. And Los Angeles is the crack capital of the world. But all the time, they are the biggest drug dealers around. They orchestrated all of it. They purposely brought that crap into our communities just so they could arrest people.
Be like, oh, it's a big problem. Yeah, they started
to
the fire
fund
and then
groups,
want credit for putting it out, trying to put it out. Yeah.
If you want to watch a really good movie, there's a movie called American Made, and it's got Tom Cruise in it. He plays a pilot that was running drugs for the CIA, and I think for cartels too or whatever, but he was a pilot, and then eventually he got to running drugs for the CIA doing all this. And it's based off a true story. It was a real pilot, and he really did it. The movie's amazing.
Recommend.
Yeah, I feel for the Kilroys because they're actively trying to do something good about it. Mm-hmm. But their leaders are looking them in the face and just lying to them.
Yeah.
About what they plan to do about drugs in the country and whatnot. And it's like when your boat is sinking and you just have a little paper cup and you're bailing out water, but a larger bucket is pouring water in.
Right.
But they're trying, you know,
trying.
And I'm sure locally, on the local level though, I bet they're doing such good work.
Yeah.
I bet they've helped a lot of people locally. So there's still hope.
A family who has done the same exact thing.
Yes,
the
you do.
Of their son. And they have a big impact even on the state level, but for sure on the local level. So
But you know, sometimes that's where it has to start, If the U.S. government is dealing drugs in large quantities, you know what? You just start with like one person in your hometown.
You start where you can. And exactly. You start small and eventually it'll grow. And if you can make a difference even with one person or yes. on one level, that's what matters. And yeah, it sucks when somebody has to die for those changes to happen. You wish it didn't have to happen that way, but it gives some purpose to that person's life that is right. gone.
You know, I like how they were able to take Mark's death and use it to spread a message of love and peace and, mm-hmm. you know, community. And they've raised so much money to help people out. And like their scholarship, like Mark wanted to be a doctor, mm-hmm. but he would have been just one doctor. Like their foundation and the money could have given money to 20 doctors
yeah.
or 40 doctors. You know, we can have so many people now that are helping other people because of Mark's legacy.
Of Mark, yeah.
So it's kind of a, I guess, a bittersweet ending
it's
to bittersweet. A crazy story.
Yeah.
You can go to markkilroyfoundation.org if you want to explore their site and make a donation. You can read the book. The book is called Sacrifice, the Tragic Cult Murder of Mark Kilroy in Matamoros.
I
you can buy it there.
I didn't want to give the title.
Yeah. That's it. Proceeds there support the foundation's work. Last time I checked, it was about $75. So that's a little expensive in today's economy for the book. But it's tax deductible.
That's a little expensive.
Yeah, it is tax deductible. Everybody do your taxes, by the way.
Yes. I got to get on that.
But yeah, the money, the foundation is still up and running. It still helps a lot of people in the area. And Mark's death did not have to be for nothing.
Right. Well, that was a crazy story. That was a dark story, but it yeah. was good. That was good.
It was a little bit of a roller coaster when I was yeah. like reading the book. I'm like, this is okay. Fun party time. I know what happens to him. So there's a feeling of dread. And then the cult yeah. murder happens. And I'm just like, what the French toast is happening?
What happened?
And then this investigation makes you infurious. Infurious.
Infurious.
I was going to say furious or infuriating. So now I become infurious. We're inventing words again.
I did that last time.
You're infuriated at how this people are ignoring them. Mm-hmm. And when you realize how things go at the upper levels, and then you feel a little more at peace, I guess, when they spread their message of love and they build a foundation to help other people. So
yeah,
it's a bit of a roller coaster
of
emotions. It is a ride.
That is a ride. Well, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And it is actually perfect timing because I ordered food and it is like being dropped off now.
Oh, nice. Do you need to go get it?
Well, it's not there yet, but it will be in a few minutes. But I was like, wow, that was timing.
I guess I could sign off now. And you
I just
eat.
Got a text and it was like, Cody's approaching with your order. I'm like, sweet.
All right, Cody. Shout out
Thanks,
to Cody.
Cody. He's probably walking up the steps. He's like, who's saying my name?
He's like, all right, I'm just delivering food. All right, well, I guess I can sign off now because your food's about to be here.
My food's here.
I hope my congestion wasn't a detriment to anybody listening.
No, I mean, I can tell that you're congested for sure.
Yeah.
But you know what? It happens. And
I didn't want to skip not doing this and like put it off another week because I know we had a couple of weeks before we had skipped and been late and all. And I'm like, I don't want to do it again. I want to be on time.
We were busy. Yes.
Yeah.
And snowstorms in December and it was a mess.
Oh gosh, yes, that was crazy. And holidays and whatnot. And
yeah. Oh, wait, hold on.
Your food
it's
has
here.
Arrived.
It's
okay. You go get your food. We love
that
you guys.
Perfect. I had no idea how long your story was gonna be. I timed that perfectly.
All right. We love you guys. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Do your
guys.
Taxes. Visit yes. markkilroyfoundation.org.
Don't join cults.
Don't join cults. Don't get help for drug abuse.
Wait, don't get help for drug abuse?
No, don't get help for drug
you
abuse.
You said don't join cults and then don't get help for drug
abuse. I'm going to have to cut that part out. That's terrible. It's a terrible message.
Please get help for drug abuse.
Yes, get help for drug abuse. Don't join cults. Do your taxes.
Yes. And yeah. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thank you. As of 2009, are you serious, Dana? Are you serious?